Good afternoon. This is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. And I have a very special guest in the studio with me today, Corey Flintoff. Usually he's in my chair, right? But he's opposite me. And if you're not familiar with him, I'm sure you are, but he's from Alaska. He was born in Fairbanks, reported out of Bethel, reported out of and anchored out of Anchorage, but went on to D.C. and Iraq and Afghanistan and Haiti. But he's back here for a little visit, and we have a great opportunity to talk to him and hear some of his stories from all these locations that he's been. So welcome, Corey.
Thank you. It's really fun to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you back. And I think we're getting a little sunshine out there for you. It's been a little rainy, but it's getting better. I know people probably who remember you from your reporting days here or are familiar with hearing you on NPR. Or I didn't know about don't tell me stint that you had. But if people want to call you, we'd just love for them to call you and ask questions and remind you of your past here. So the number's 550-8433. And if you're outside Anchorage, you can call 1-888-353-5752 or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. Also, we want to send folks to our website. We've got alaskapublic.org, and attached to this show, we've got a couple of clips there, some bio on Corey, some of his recent stories or some of his highlighted stories from NPR, a couple of vintage things there that might be fun to go and see. So don't forget to visit our website. So anyway, Corey, I had the chance of hearing you interviewed last night at the museum as part of the speaker series. That was really fun.
Yeah, but you always have to ask yourself, what is it that I'm finally getting to the point where I'm in a museum and I'm being interviewed? You know?
What's the world come to that
right.
I'm the subject of the interview? Well, you know, look at your track record. I mean, it's been fascinating. We have a few people from Alaska who've ended up on the national scene, more than a few,
yeah.
Actually. But you're one of them and you're back. And so it's fun to think about tracing. How did you get from Fairbanks, you know, to Haiti? I always knew about Bethel, but I didn't realize there was things in between Bethel. So I thought you could tell us just a little bit about your early years. You know, why were you in Fairbanks? How did your family get there? And then what did you do and how did you land in Bethel?
Well, actually, one of the great prides of my life is that my family comes from Fairbanks. My father was born in Fairbanks in 1912.
Oh.
And he was born on a mining claim on Goldstream Creek. And,
wow.
He never had a birth certificate, of course, but when he went to get a passport sometime in the late 50s, it was still a territory. So he had to go before the territorial commissioner and bring an old-timer with him who would testify that he had heard that my father was born on number 10 above Discovery on Goldstream Creek.
I vouch for that.
Yes. And it happened that my father, who, you know, knew his way around the bars of Fairbanks in the 1950s and had a lot of old-timer friends, had no problem whatever coming up with someone who'd say whatever he wanted them to.
And so, and then he met your mom there, or your mom met him there?
Yes, actually, my mother was from Buffalo, New York, and she worked in New York City for a while. But during the war, at any rate, at the start of construction of the Alcan Highway, she came up as part of a secretarial pool that worked for the Army Engineers and was doing the administrative stuff for the Alcan Highway. So she flew up to Fairbanks from Edmonton, I think, sometime in the late 40s, maybe 44, in the middle of the winter. And with in a plane load of young women who were all going
all
up there.
All single.
Yes.
Oh, my
absolutely.
Gosh.
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was one woman who wouldn't get off the plane. She took one look at Fairbanks out the window, and that was enough.
I'm going home.
Exactly.
But your mom got off.
Yes, she did. And actually, having worked in New York, she was a clothes model. Not a runway model, but what they call a clothes horse. And that's the person who at big department stores would walk out in the ladies' lounge with a dress on and say, you know, this swirl around and say, you know, this is 1995, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she, as a result, as a young clothes horse, she had collected a lot of these dresses, like especially ball dresses and things like that.
Perfect for Alaska, right?
Well, she put them in a trunk and she brought them up with her. And she would wear them one at a time, and after she'd worn it, she would sell it.
Smart.
To the other women who were there. Yes.
Smart.
So these dresses had, you know, they had a life of their own.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah.
And really how smart she was.
Yeah.
I mean, she's perfect for Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And then she worked with the highway people for a while, but then...
She worked for the Army Corps of Engineers, and she became friends with Otto Geist. And you probably, I mean, most
recognize
people know
that name.
Otto Geist was a famous paleontologist who did a lot of the early work. And not just paleontology, but he did a lot of the work in the gold tailing piles in all around, you know, where all the dredging has taken place around Fairbanks.
Right.
Because a lot of bison and mastodon remains were washing out of the hillsides at
wow.
that point.
Wow.
So he did a lot of that work, but he had also done a lot of work he was never a certified scientist, but he did a little anthropology, a little archaeology, a little of this and that, and he did some of the first excavations on St. Lawrence Island. So he actually was a guy who was in the right place at the right time.
Did she work for him?
She did. Well, she worked for him as in the Army Corps of Engineers.
He was
working there at the time. He eventually wound up at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks and became, at that point, a real authority
right.
on Alaska paleontology. But he was a good friend of my father, who at that time had come up there. My father had been born there and then had gone down and lived in the Pacific Northwest for quite a while. But, you know, when the war came along, he gravitated back up to Fairbanks and he did a little mining. And then he went to work for the Army he was a steam fitter at this big power plant on what was then Ladd Field in Fairbanks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, and he was a local boy. And in fact, when my mother met him and then wrote home to her aunt who had raised her and said, well, I'm going to marry an Alaska native. He was, in fact, you know.
And, yeah. Well, that's great. So your roots are really, really deep, deep here then. It's not just a job you had in Bethel. It was,
exactly right.
You
yeah.
know, your mom, your dad. Yeah. But how long did you guys stay in Fairbanks?
Well, my father died in 57, I think it was. before that, I should say, they had a hotel.
Oh.
Because my father was a steam fitter. He, you know, was able to keep any kind of heating system running, which in Fairbanks was a big issue at the time.
Total job security in Fairbanks.
Exactly. They had under-the-street steam heat at the time. So, you know, all these bars on 2nd Avenue all had radiators in there that were run from the power plant. But they had a hotel called the Palace Rooms, which some people may actually still remember.
Wow.
It was a kind of a, at the time we had it, it was a kind of a flea bag hotel. It was a two-story log building with a liquor store in the front.
Of course.
And a dormitory in the back, so that if you couldn't afford one of the rooms, which had no running water, you could
get
afford a bed.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, for instance, miners would come in from Healy and places like that, and they'd come in with all their payday and stay
wow.
in the dormitory. Or...
A lot of color, a lot of history there.
Exactly.
Really rich. Well, we've got a caller, and I want to make sure they get to talk to you.
Oh,
so,
good.
Hi, Linda. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi there. Yes, I wanted to say hello to Corey Flintoff. I had been a original member of KSKA Radio living here, and then I moved to Washington, D.C., and I was so homesick for Alaska, and I was listening to public radio, and there was Corey Flintoff's voice.
A voice from home.
Yeah, exactly. So I've just been so proud of him, listening to him over the years, at the success of his reporting career. And to find out that he's in India now, I hadn't realized that. What can you tell us about all of these adventures?
You know, I have to fess up. I left India on my little bio page because it...
Sounds good.
Truthfully, it sounded good. It was sort of more exotic than being back in Washington. But for the last couple of months, I've been back in Washington. And I'm the foreign policy writer for NPR's website at the moment.
Wow. Great. So we're gonna hear lots of stories, Linda, I'm sure, today.
I hope we hear your voice. It's a marvelous one.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks
bye-bye. Linda. So, Corey, we're going to talk about Bethel APRN, but to sort of set the mood, we're going to play a little vintage clip for you. So this is something that you'll recognize from April 3rd, 1989.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. More on the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster tonight. Captain Hazelwood's lawyer says he may return voluntarily to face criminal charges. And the herring season in Prince William Sound has been canceled. Good evening. I'm Corey Flintoe. Also tonight, two firsthand reports from reporters in the field in Prince William Sound, Bob King on the cleanup of Green Island, and Claire Richardson in the Bird and Animal Rehabilitation Center. An attorney for fired Exxon Valdez skipper Joseph Hazelwood says the captain may return to Alaska, where he's wanted on criminal charges stemming from the oil spill disaster. That news came from the Attorney General's office as North America's largest oil spill continued to ooze out of Prince William Sound and into the Gulf of Alaska. Peter Kenyon has this update.
Alaska's criminal prosecutions director.
So, does that bring you back a little bit, Corey?
Oh, it does, absolutely.
I mean, to me, it was one of the biggest events. I was working here, too, and when that happened, March 24th, something. What was it like to be in the newsroom at APRN, and what were your news meetings like? How were you dispatching reporters? What was it like?
You know, I think it's probably not so different from being at the Daily News. You know, I mean, we were kind of overwhelmed by this, frankly. And I mean, among us, we didn't have an awful lot of big-time news experience. I think Steve Heimel was the most experienced reporter among us, and who had, you know, knew how to handle a really, really big story, and a story that was obviously going to take days and months to report.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, we also had a lot of really talented reporters at the stations at the time who, and it had never occurred to us to deploy somebody from Dillingham to Prince William Sound. It just didn't seem,
yeah.
We didn't have a story.
They reported on their community.
Exactly.
You didn't
right.
send them someplace else.
So, but we did get Bob King to go to Prince William Sound, and he did. And that particular day, that report that he did was absolutely stunning. And if I recall correctly, I think he did a version of it for NPR.
Oh.
And it was one of the things that showed people outside, how devastating this really was. One of the sounds in that report, if I'm not mistaken, on Green Island, is the sound of a seabird dying in the oil.
Oh.
And it's, it was awe-chilling
captures
to listen to. Yeah, heartbreaking
in
to listen
one moment,
to.
It captures the horribleness
exactly
of the whole event.
Right.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, it was a brilliant piece of work.
So you were blessed by having Steve Heimel.
Yes.
And blessed by having these young reporters out there that were probably game to go.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got another caller. Randy, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Thanks. I enjoy your reporting, Corey.
Oh, thank you.
And I wondered how you prepare for some of your overseas assignments. They seem somewhat dangerous, and wonder if you've been through training or if growing up in Fairbanks you learned to still in the practice.
That was all the training you had.
Yeah, that's right. You know, before they send you overseas on these things, and before I went through Iraq the first time, for instance, they have something called hostile environment training that they send not just reporters, but anybody who works in these areas usually will get some version of this. And it's like a week-long training program where you do a lot of first aid refresher courses and a certain amount of mock. For instance, that we had a mock guerrilla attack in which everybody was kidnapped and you had to figure out the safest thing that you could possibly do under the circumstances. So you do this, but it really has no relation to what you're going to run into in a foreign culture, it gives you a certain amount of confidence the first time you go, and I think that's kind of the whole purpose.
You must have to really read. I mean, you really have to. The world, so many events changing so fast. I mean, when you're going into a country like Iraq, of course, you're reading and reading. But do you sit down with veteran reporters when you get there?
Yes, absolutely. You know, that's the thing about being a foreign correspondent is that, you know, there was a kind of a club.
Yeah,
you know,
you're not the first guy to show up.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. What about
Haiti, where, you know, there's issues of water and sanitation and food? How do you deal with those things?
That's true. Well, in the case of Haiti, we brought in all, for the first couple of weeks, we brought in all our water. You know, if you can imagine, like, a pallet load of bottled water. I flew in there. When I went there, there was, of course, no regular flights going in. And I got in there on a charter flight that the Associated Press had arranged to bring in their own stuff. And I just flew in the jump seat with the guys, the charter pilots. So, you know, I mean, we brought everything that we possibly could.
Yeah.
And at that time...
You don't travel light.
No, you really don't travel light. But at that time, things were so desperate that you would load your stuff on a truck and drive it through Port-au-Prince, and people would snatch everything that they could off the truck as you drove through. So the idea was to bring enough extra that you knew you were going to lose some, just a desperation.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, thanks. Keep up the good reporting.
Oh, thank you.
Caroline, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Yes, good afternoon. Mr. Flintoff, I really, really am thrilled to know. I missed some of your background before, but the fact that you came out of Fairbanks back in the day, my daughter was just under 5 and my son was an infant in 1967.
Ah, that would be about right.
And stepping off the plane, originally from Florida, having lived 2 years in American Samoa, getting off that plane at minus 30 below the Pan Am, I'm telling you, it just totally takes your breath away, but not in the way a lot of people might use that phrase. But I was so thrilled with my time there. We were there only 1 year, and then out back for 2, and then back in 70 permanently. But the thing I saw, having come out of the racist South, I loved the way people got along. And I attributed it to the fact that at 40 below, you don't care who stops to help you. And the community pulled together on so many things. And I was just curious, one fellow, I won't tell you what his name is because you'd probably recognize it, said that it was the kind of place that if you could reach up to the bar to put your money on it, you could get a beer. He was about 9 years old, I guess, when he got his first beer. And because of the wonderful attitude of everyone looking out for each other, that was apparently not really a problem. My question to you, though, is, in your experiences in that harsh environment and the community that it brought out, how has that helped you adjust to all the places that you've gone to and reported from? So, again, thank you. I'm sure you know a lot of the same people that used to be there, Peggy Goldeisen, who's passed.
Mm-hmm. She baked me a birthday cake one time.
She made birthday cakes for people your age, young people, then their wedding cake, and then their kids' birthday cake. So the continuity of the old-timers was just a part of the pleasure of having a chance to have been there during those days. So thank you very much for all the good that you've done for Alaska.
Thanks for calling. You know, I have to say, you know, I mean, it's true that Fairbanks is a very open place, and it's, you know, and it's gotten more open as time has gone on, I think. But, you know, Fairbanks did have its fraught racial history as well.
It's not all warm and rosy.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, this was a place where some hotels and bars certainly had, you know, no dogs, no natives allowed on it. And that's a blight on the history of the place, you know, that lasted for a really long time,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Mm-hmm.
Fairbanks was also not a very integrated place, you know, as far as black people from the lower 48 were concerned, until enough, you know, people in the service came up there, you know, enough black people came up to sort of establish, you know, who they were and,
right.
you know, that they had a place there and that they were, you know, they settled there and they became Alaskans as well, you know.
Yeah.
But none of that was really as easy as you would think, and merely the fact that it's a hard place and people have to help each other
doesn't get us over all those humps.
It doesn't. No, I mean, those things always take time.
Well, do you think that the there is something to the resiliency that you and the self-reliance that might have you might have carried that forward to you with into some assignments that were scary
or
unsettling.
You know, a tolerance for discomfort anyway, you know, or not knowing any better, you
yeah.
know. Because I did actually spend quite a lot of time when I was a kid out on the homestead of some friends of ours. You know, it was a no electricity, no running water situation. And that's always good for you, I think. You know, I mean, it makes everything look much more comfortable when you get into a place that has those things.
When you get an indoor toilet.
Yes, exactly.
It's luxurious.
That's right.
So, well, I started talking about, Fairbanks, and I wanted to get to the fact that you were outside of Alaska for a while, which probably had some influence on you before you came back to Bethel. So tell us about that.
Yes, well, after my father died, my mother, who was working for Pan American Airways, was sort of in the heyday of that great airline, got transferred to San Francisco. And so I went to high school in San Francisco. And that was, you know, coming from a place where, you know, we spent time in places that had no running water and electricity to, you know, one of the sort of most cosmopolitan cities to this day,
absolutely,
you know, that
yeah.
that I know of, was a real revelation, and it was really good for me. You know, I mean, I think it's good.
You went from one end of the spectrum to the other.
Exactly right.
And
exactly
that
right.
shapes your view of the world a bit.
You know, I think it makes people to whom this happens, and I mean, this is really an American story. I mean, people come from the farm, you know, and
yes.
they go to urban areas.
That's
and
right.
They go to college and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it makes a sort of interesting person. It makes you a bit rootless because you can't quite settle in the rural area and you can't quite settle in the big city, or you can't stay in one or the
right.
other.
Right. You're just
you know.
On one foot, then on the other foot.
Exactly right. And, you know, that's a
yeah.
very American situation
yeah.
to be in.
Yeah.
I think that's why we
yeah.
all move around
that's,
so much.
That would be my story. If you're just joining us, I want you to know you probably already know that's Corey Flintoff. You recognize his voice from NPR, but he's our guest today on Hometown Alaska. And if you've got questions for him or you just want to tell him how much you appreciate his work, give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 or give us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So anyway, Corey, I wanted to sort of find out a little bit. When we were talking about the Exxon Valdez and, you know, you're sort of arriving there with mostly reporting experience from KYUK, which I think you characterize as I told a lot of stories, but I didn't do a lot of news.
Yes, well, yeah. No, I mean, you know, we did the school board meetings and the city council meetings. And,
sure.
You know, that
news
was,
in that town.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. But news in a small town is sometimes hard to tell.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
Because, everybody knows you and where you live.
That's right. And you meet them at the post office every day. So.
And they tell you how they feel about what you just report. So it's got its own benefits training ground-wise.
Exactly.
I wanted to tell our listeners, we do have a clip on Alaska Public of Corey back in the day. This is 1982, election night coverage in Bethel with Carol Schatz, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it brings back names like Steve Cowper and Bill Sheffield and Tom Fink and all these, you know, and the vote count was like 2 for this candidate, 50 for that. And then there was some analysis there, too. You know, it was very charming. But the one thing I'll tell you is your voice is still as comfortable and relaxed in Bethel as it is today coming out of, you know, NPR. So that must have been just a natural talent for you.
I've always sounded this way, and in fact, most of the men in my family sound this way. My cousins have this sound, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing about it is, it turns out to be a good radio voice, but in fact, you know, the fashion has changed, and the big booming radio voice
really?
Is kind of not as desirable as it used to be. NPR. And, you know, it's part of NPR's lovely mission statement. I mean, one of the greatest things that the organization ever did was write a mission statement that said that we would be inclusive. And one of the things that it was, we will broadcast the voices of America.
Oh.
And so one of the criteria of choosing reporters is that they wouldn't all have this big radio voice. You know, in fact, they'd sound a lot more like our friends and neighbors, you know, and that's something that they've done, I think, very successfully.
Pretty interesting. That's an interesting evolution. I mean, the country is, I mean, even Alaska has so many people coming from all over the world, and certainly the United States does too. So it's, the diversity is just growing and growing and growing. So NPR wants to sound like its audience.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you're still in the audience, Corey. There's still plenty of you in the audience. So let's see. We went from, I wanted to San Francisco, then to Bethel. How did you get back to Bethel?
Actually, I went to graduate school in Chicago, and I met a young woman there whose name was Sasha Bartalski, and she was in dental school. She was finishing her dental school, and in order to pay her way through dental school, she had gotten loans from the Indian Health Service and, of course, had to go and put in some time, you know, at an Indian Health Service hospital or clinic. And so I said, you know, you have choices of places like New Mexico and so forth, but Alaska obviously is one of the biggest ones. And I said, well, let's go to Alaska.
Sure, why not? I know Alaska.
Absolutely. Well, I thought I did. I had no idea. And the two places that came up, you know, as possible places to be stationed were places that I knew nothing of whatsoever. One of them was Ketchikan and the other was Bethel.
Oh.
And, you know.
Two very different places.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, of course, totally different from
Fairbanks.
Yes.
Sure.
I mean, at that time, I knew nothing about Anchorage either.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So
right.
It's one of those things that people in the news business need to remember all the time, and that is that you never see more than a small slice of anything. And so what you think is the center of the world, you know, turns out to be, you know, a very peripheral thing to other people.
Your little view of it. We've got another caller. I'd like to squeeze him in. Hi, Scott. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Corey, I used to work at KIYU in Galena when you were at APRN, and I appreciate all the efforts that you helped me shape my little journalism career that I had for a while.
Oh, that's great.
I really appreciated all the tips and traps you gave me in reporting from there. And I like what you just said about bringing the voices of America on. That was something I definitely tried to do. I lived in Galena. I always get the voices of Galena with a brand new radio station. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Glad to have you back in Alaska for a little bit.
I still have my Galena T-shirt, my Galena radio station T-shirt.
That's great.
All right. Very cool.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, thank you.
It made me think of my days at the Nome Nugget, which I told you I was there briefly for about a year, and I got to go to the Savunga Walrus Carnival, and I still have that T-shirt, and I prize it. You know, it's just wonderful, you know, getting out to some of those places. So, but anyway, so you were in Bethel because your wife was basically paying back for her education.
Exactly right. So, and my thought at the time was, well, you know, I had always wanted to write a novel, and I thought, you know, what better? You know, long nights and, you know, plenty of time and
quiet.
I was going to do this. And, but of course, I needed a job, you know, to keep myself afloat. And I asked one of the doctors at the Public Health Service Hospital there, well, what do you do for jobs around town? And he said, well, go at the radio station. They always need somebody. So the very next day, I went to KYUK, and sure enough, they needed somebody. And,
right now.
Yeah.
Probably.
So they put me on the air the very next day.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and the really important thing to know about Bethel is it has 56 Yupik, mostly Yupik, and some Athabascan villages, all of which have names that are really difficult to pronounce until you get the hang of them.
Oh, yeah.
So,
it takes a while. Yeah.
Exactly. That was the important thing, you know, to learn how to pronounce, Napuskiak and Napakiak. I'm just trying to, they're all coming back to me now.
Yeah, it's in that file cabinet back there.
It is, exactly. Yeah.
I know I read on your bio that you were able to learn enough Yupik to do the call letters. The station identification could you do it again? I mean, is it still there?
Oh, yeah, it's still there.
Go ahead.
Ni chugni uchi, ni chugni sutkun, KYUK mak mani mam tereslami.
Wow.
It means you're listening to KYUK in Bethel.
That's so terrific. We're going to take a little break, but we're going to come back to another little vintage clip that maybe might provoke some memories from you. So stay with us. This is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage, and you can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website, alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA FM 91.1.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy, and I'm thrilled to have a guest, Corey Flintoff, with us today. Welcome back, Corey.
Oh, thank you.
We've been just really enjoying the stories of early Fairbanks and arriving in Bethel and figuring out where your voice came from. It's the men, the Flintoff men have this voice. So anyway, we have another clip that we'd love to play. It's been fun finding these Alaska News Nightly clips that the station here is digitizing them, and so they're sort of rediscovering all these things. It's really fun. So when we knew you were coming, we wanted to find a few. So here's another clip, and it comes from October 10th, 1984.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. A state plan for dealing with trespass cabins on state land is drawing protests in Fairbanks. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, more on the Vico campaign finance controversy, and the Alaska Native Review Commission takes up the issue of subsistence.
Hey, so the reason I liked that clip was because it brought up some of the big stories that have lived for decades here in Alaska, and that was just the tip of the iceberg on Vico.
Exactly.
And can you recall those days? Can you remember sort of, what did you think? Did you think, okay, we'll get this straightened out, or did you have any inkling that it was going to turn into the huge story that
it
did?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea, and usually that's true. I mean, I suppose maybe Woodward and Bernstein knew that they were onto something big with the Watergate scandal,
yeah.
But I think for the most part, reporters very often don't know, you know,
yeah.
and you as a print reporter know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and when it's shown, you know, something like the Watergate investigation is shown, you know, in a movie, that's all those guys were doing. And, you know, they have, you know, seemingly endless time and endless resources.
But that's
resources.
Not really the way it is, right?
No, yeah, you're working on three or four or five different stories at any given time.
Yeah.
You know, you really don't have much time. You really don't have the resources.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking to people and you're never quite sure, you know, whether,
yeah.
you know, A, are they reliable and trustworthy? And B, do they know what they think they know?
Right.
You know, so you know, it's you're always on really slippery ground when you're doing
yeah.
this kind of story. You know?
Yeah, and who knew that there were such deep roots in that story?
Yes.
And that, I mean, it would reach all the way to, you know, Ted Stevens, you know, the Alaska legislature. It would take years for it all to unfold. But boy, it actually took the Exxon Valdez to finance, you know, Vico. They were the oil spill cleanup team and made a lot of money there and came back with a lot of influence and purchased the Anchorage Times, you know, really tried to influence the legislature. It was fascinating history. You were there for part of that, only really the Exxon Valdez,
mm-hmm.
and you sort of did a transition then. Tell us about that, because you didn't stay in Alaska all that much longer after the Exxon Valdez.
That's right. Well, it's sort of the dirty little secret in a lot of reporters' careers that there's some disaster that kind of propels you into the attention of whatever your next big job will be. And in my case, it was, you know, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, because that got the attention of people at NPR.
Yeah.
They sent their own reporters here. In fact, people who are still associated with public radio, one of them was Ira Glass.
Oh.
He, from This American
he
Life.
He came to Alaska?
He came to Alaska.
I don't remember that.
Danny Zwerdling, who is still, you know, I mean, one of the premier investigative reporters in broadcasting, came up here.
So, yeah. And so you were meeting all of them, and you were probably also talking to the headquarters, I guess, about
maybe
sending some of your reporters' reports back.
So. Yes, and doing reports of my own. So all that, you know, sort of makes those connections for you. And at some point somebody said, well, when all this is over, why don't you come to Washington for a few weeks? And what they did at the time was they'd have you fill in as an editor or on one of the desks there. Mm-hmm. And it would sort of get you acquainted with the NPR way of doing things. So I did that. And, you know, once you're in a situation like that, you look around and you think, oh, I could do this.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm ready for the big time.
You're right. I didn't know how wrong I was, but, you know, you don't need to know until it's too late.
Yeah. And then your resiliency kicks in, right?
Exactly right.
Well, listen, we've got some more callers. Want to give them a shot. Hi, Chuck. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi. Hey, I remember hearing Corey, and suddenly I heard him on NPR. And that sort of happened with Peter Kenyon. You were talking about that. Played that recording with from the Exxon Valdez. Peter Kenyon was on there, too. And I know some others, although right now I draw a blank on their names. There's been a small contingent of Alaska reporters gone to.
Absolutely, I can tell you.
I was wondering if you guys keep in touch. And, of course, I know you get assigned hither and yon, so you're probably not local to each other. But I often wonder if the former Alaska contingent people still kind of keep in touch, because we're so unique.
We're so special.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you use that notion. I had it in my notes here to ask you, Corey, about the Alaska Mafia that seemed, you know, to go in from Alaska radio, public radio, into the national scene. There, you know, I can think of Peter Kenyon, but there was Elizabeth Arnold, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
You, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm missing other people, but big-time reporters were coming here, but some of our talent was being sucked into NPR.
So. You may remember Karen Michelle McPherson, who was a really, really good arts producer, especially arts and culture producer from Fairbanks.
Yes,
who's now in New York.
Yes.
Margot Melnikov, who was a reporter from Juneau for a long time, who really did some really marvelous stuff. She's still in radio.
Wow, that's you know, one of the things I thought of, Alaska was so remote, and it had such a network of public radio that I wondered if we were unique at the time, and that led to some of them being pulled into the national scene. Do you think that was true?
I think so, but you know, one of the things about Alaska is that it's always so much more cosmopolitan than it really should be, you know, for a state with a population this size and in being relatively remote and all.
Yeah.
You'd think that it would be a rather parochial provincial place, but of course it's not, because it attracts people from all over the country.
Right.
You know, people who are here for the adventure or
the beauty,
the business, the scientific
opportunities, job opportunities,
whatever. Yeah,
I probably think a lot of young people in radio ended up here because there was such opportunity here.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So that's I don't know. It just makes us all still proud when we hear, you know, Peter Kenyon reporting or your voice. It's just kind of cool, you know. So, but let's see. What else do we want? There's so much I want to talk about. I was thinking about how much change you have lived through. I know last night you told a little anecdote about cutting reel-to-reel tape and throw it around your neck and then sticking it in a report, and it wasn't exactly what you thought.
Exactly that, yeah.
I mean, tell that story, because that's really funny.
Oh, this the sort of thing used to happen all the time. But, you know, when we were producing Alaska News Nightly, and in fact before that, all that stuff was done on reel-to-reel tape. And, you know, you had to physically cut it with a razor blade. You did your edits, you know, and physically and in real time. And, of course, once you've cut a strip of tape from a reel, you know, it might be, you know, 6 or 8 feet long, you have to identify it. And if you're really smart, you used to write on it with a wax pencil saying what it was. And you'd put a little arrow to show that the tape, make sure the tape was going in the right direction.
In the right direction. Yeah. Even that.
And then you'd have to splice it back into a reel, you know, and it was Actually, a lot of us got really good at this. I mean,
I'm sure.
We became real masters of it, and it's something that became totally obsolete.
Yeah. You know,
and there's absolutely no use for it whatsoever anymore.
Yeah.
But anyway, obviously, it created a lot of opportunities to make mistakes because you'd have these pieces of unlabeled tape floating around. Sometimes you'd tape them to the wall, or sometimes you'd hang them around your neck. But when it came time to putting the program together and getting ready for Alaska News Nightly, a lot of times these things didn't always fall into the right slot.
Uh-oh.
So in this particular case, I remember we had done something. I don't know if people remember Mr. T anymore. He was this television personality guy with a big mohawk.
Yeah.
And his catchphrase was, "I pity the fool." And it happened that we had, he had some connection with Alaska, and to tell you the truth, I don't remember what it was, but we had a little segment on him.
He was in your newscast.
It was paired with a segment with Tony Knowles, and Tony Knowles talking about, I forget what the particular Anchorage product, but you can hear this coming, right?
Oh, yes.
So I introduce Tony Knowles, and I lead into him, and the first thing, of course, that he says is, "I pity the fool."
Did you hear from Tony Knowles after that?
No. As a matter of fact, I didn't.
He's a good sport, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you keep it together when that happened?
Usually, a combination of sort of deer in the headlights, shock and embarrassment. You know, you just sort of come out of it and kind of keep going in this kind of unsteady, way.
Hopefully block that out and just hope for smoother sailing ahead.
That's right.
Right. Well, we've got a caller. I want to let him talk to you. Bob, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Thanks. Corey, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's really nice to have you home again, briefly. I just wanted to say that I think you're really disarmingly unpresuming in the way you present yourself, disarming, and it's really refreshing. I think you've had a great career here, and especially nationally and internationally. Good job. Can you tell us a little bit about what might be next as far as a Bureau assignment, and if it happens, how you're going to deal with the Russian mafia?
He sounds like he's got an inkling as to what it might be.
I actually told people at the museum presentation last night that I've applied for the Moscow correspondent job.
Exciting.
And what inspired me is that I was in Moscow for about 6 weeks in February and March in the run-up to the presidential election. Mm-hmm. And, climate-wise, of course, is very much like Anchorage.
This feels familiar.
Exactly, yeah. And but, of course, it's a really exciting milieu, and, there's lots of intriguing things going on. You know, they're a big resource-extractive economy.
Similarities to Alaska,
exactly, right. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the overlay of Russian culture and,
very rich.
As you say, the Russian.
And then there's the vodka.
Yes, exactly. It's like cutting your own tape. There are a lot of things that can go wrong.
Yeah. But that sounds exciting.
Yeah. So, if that were to be the next assignment, I don't know how you deal with the Russian mafia or with criminal organizations of any kind. I mean, I think, you just have to do your best reporting. And one thing that NPR has always been very good at, in fact, the guy who hired me, my former boss, Lauren Jenkins, he always said, there's never any shame in being thrown out of a repressive country for doing good reporting.
That's stand up.
Yeah, so if you get kicked out, the organization will support you, basically.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, Bob, go ahead.
No, thanks. That's great. Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's really exciting. So are you reading everything you can read?
And, absolutely.
Yeah, both historically and contemporary.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see. Where's Putin these days?
Actually, the sort of interesting thing is that Putin was supposed to come to Washington to Camp David for the G8 summit meeting over this past weekend, and he didn't come. He sent Dmitry Medvedev in his place.
Mm-hmm.
And, Putin is now the president, of course, and Medvedev is the prime minister. But Putin's excuse was that he had to stay behind and work on the structure of the new government. Well, that's the job of the prime minister. It's not the job of the
but
president.
But he's had both those jobs, and
exactly.
He probably still has both those jobs.
But the fact that he didn't come and perform his role as president, you know, in an international setting, suggests that things are not all as they should be back home.
Shouldn't leave home. Not a good time to leave home.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, of course, there's all the speculation about what that means.
Ah, wow. When might you end up there? Is it a couple months from now?
It probably would be sometime in late summer.
So you'll be back at NPR for a while. And,
mm-hmm.
and well, as you said last night at the museum, if we hear you from Moscow, we know you got the job.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I also said last night that, you know, you're really not supposed to say, talk about these things, because then if you don't get the job, you're embarrassed about it.
But the whole world knows,
after all, among friends, so I think it's probably all
right. Yeah, and you've done such great work for so long. I mean, I don't know. You'll do something interesting if you don't do that. Well, I want to throw our numbers out one more time for folks in case we've got a few minutes left here. Corey Flintoff, and you can talk to him at 550-8433, 1-888-353-5752, or give us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So since you're here and you're an experienced journalist, I thought I'd also ask you a couple journalism questions, Really, we've lived through so much change. We've seen, almost like the core news organizations sharing the stage with just about everybody that wants to talk. And I just wonder whether you think we're going to settle down. We're going to get some voices you can trust that are going to emerge. I mean, that's clearly NPR has worked hard for that, keeping its foreign correspondents out there. But what do you think? I mean, do you feel pessimistic or optimistic about the future?
I've gone through, several permutations about how I feel about the future of journalism. And at the moment, I'm feeling very optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because although journalism as we know it and the journalism outlets that we know are contracting or even collapsing, newspapers are all having trouble. Broadcast radio is, barely holding its own,
White knuckle.
Exactly. And the question is, well, so where do we go from here? Obviously we go where the audience is, and the audience is on the web now in many ways and on social media.
Right.
And we just need to figure out a way to do good journalism on all those different platforms. But I've been very impressed by young reporters and young bloggers. We all know that there's a lot of junk out there, and in fact, there's a lot of lies and misleading stories and all this kind of stuff out there.
Yeah.
But you encounter that all the time. You do find the bloggers that you can trust, and the news sites that you can trust.
Yeah, I know you said last night that we're out there embedded with the military, Fox News was really popular, although there were people interested in NPR. As various news organizations kind of conglomerate and then sort of take one end of the spectrum, I was going to say that's one of the things we see today, but we saw that back in the early 1900s,
exactly,
right?
Yes.
So it's not as if we had this pristine past where everything was always up and up and right on the money, and suddenly we've slipped back into it. We've almost returned to some of our early heritage.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I had to do a project one time where I spent a lot of time looking at newspapers and microfilm, especially around the turn of the century and the period of the Spanish-American War, and I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked at the sort of in-your-face tabloidism of the papers in that day.
Right. People buying papers, Hearst, with an agenda.
Yeah.
Which, we see today with Rupert Murdoch. Some people would say that. But it's just, I guess it makes you sort of think, well, maybe we're not going to hell in a handbasket after all. We've been in this turf before. There's a lot more tools out there. There's a lot more speed. Things happen very fast. These might be advantages that we didn't have back then that maybe will surface and be really useful.
Yeah, today. I think that's true.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think NPR has changed much in light of these, the current times we're in?
Yeah, and very consciously, too. Mm-hmm. The organization has done a lot of planning and thinking about this and actually made a lot of experiments, try to figure out how do we shift good storytelling onto these other platforms.
Right.
We failed, we failed repeatedly in some of these things. But I think, you know, for instance, NPR's website has improved enormously over the last couple of years. And we are figuring out how to do that better.
I know.
What we need to do is figure out how to get audio on the air and get people to listen to it on the web.
Well, I think that idea that you can get it whenever you want it, you know, that you don't actually have to be tuned in at a certain time to catch that, that's a big advantage. I don't know whether the audience is there yet and understanding that they can, at 6:30 at night, they can dial up that thing that they couldn't be there for at 4 o'clock. But that's probably going to be a tremendous advantage at some point. So I'd love to welcome another caller. Hello, Heather. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi, Corey. It's
hi.
Heather Flynn.
Oh, hi, Heather.
Sorry I missed you last night, but I just wanted to reminisce about one wonderful thing. The first time I ever went to the NPR headquarters over on Mass Ave in D.C., I went all over the place and saw all my friends and one thing and another, and I said, well, where's Corey? And they said, well, he's on sabbatical. He's in Mongolia. And I got your email. I emailed you, hi, what you doing, da-da-da-da. And you wrote me back this wonderful email, which I shared with half of Alaska. And you talked about, you know, wind and cold and interrupted electricity. And you said, a lot like being in Bethel.
Yeah, it's true.
I have been to Mongolia, and so I really appreciated your insights from there. And that I just wanted to say hi, and that's it.
Oh, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, the Mongolia was the beginning of my foreign travel career. That was a fellowship to teach journalism and radio production in Mongolia for 6 months. And, it sort of reignited the travel bug.
Right. I don't think we said during the program that your mom had been a travel agent, right?
Yes. Well, she was a reservations clerk for Pan Am.
And so way back, you were traveling as a very young person. And so you just essentially found a career that would have let you continue to do that.
Exactly right. I mean, lots of, and you'd be surprised, I mean, really hot shot foreign correspondents talk about it as paid tourism.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
for
them, it's really all about going to the next country and seeing the next culture and sort of trying to learn whatever there is to be learned
right.
there.
Which is a wonderful thing about journalism is you're always learning. You have to always be learning. And that's part of the fun, really.
Exactly.
Although it's challenging, it's still really, really fun. You know, one of the other thoughts I had was, since you've been out of the United States so much, reporting, telling us about the world, but you've been looking back at the United States, and I'm really interested in your thoughts, sort of overhearing people from around the world talk about us and also just looking at us from a distance. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, that came up last night, too, and I was thinking that, you know, really, people's perceptions of Americans as people haven't changed very much. Americans are still very well liked around the world, I think, amazingly so, even in places where our government is not well liked. You know, in Afghanistan, for instance, I have interviewed Taliban, members of the Taliban, who, you know, have every reason to hate the United States, and they were perfectly fine with me being an American. You know, that was not the problem, you know, and people in other parts of the world, Pakistan, for instance, and India, do separate Americans as a culture and Americans as a people from, you know, the American government. You know, they're much more sophisticated in that way, you know,
So we don't have to feel that we can't go out there.
Exactly right.
But also, you know, how do you think we're doing? And I guess I am saying it's part of perception, but it's also, you know, you're actually out of our milieu, so you can see things better when you're not right in the middle of it. So I just wonder how, you know, there's a lot of polarization back here. Maybe you see that in the countries you're reporting in. I don't know. I mean, you know, do you think it's almost like our center hasn't held a little bit here? We're out on the fringes. And do you notice that when you're overseas? Do you see it?
You know, I've tried to explain to people overseas, you know, talking about American politics, you know, and saying, oh, I really feel that it's very polarized, you know, and when you try to explain this to them, it doesn't really ring very seriously because, you know, politics in most of the rest of the world are really polarized. they have been for a long time. You know, I mean, France, you know, a socialist just got into office, after Sarkozy, you know, as a sort of center-right person came in. You know, so there's always that tension in other people's politics, you know, and they tend not to see it as
polarization.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just two sides of the. So that's interesting. Maybe that's it. Maybe we're just living through a phase, you know, and it's not that. Any other insights looking back at the United States from away?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, the things that turn up, for instance, in the Indian newspapers are almost invariably oddities. You know, odd little features. You know, there was a picture in the paper today of a tranquilized bear falling out of a tree into a net. Uh-huh. And I don't know if you saw that, but it was today's front page, I think, or in today's paper. Uh-huh. That's the kind of thing that turns up in foreign newspapers about American news. You know?
They've got bears falling out of the trees.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, people do. Their impression really has to do with natural disasters. You know, they believe that we have lots of natural disasters in the United States.
Because that's what we report.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And they also believe in these sort of quirky little, you know, stories about wildlife falling out of trees. You know, and it makes you think about what we hear about what goes on in foreign countries, and you realize that it often is stuff that would appear very trivial to them.
Right. Know? Well, actually, you said something earlier about a reporter needs to know that they're just looking at one tiny little piece of something, and that's, you know, true. It's an argument, I guess, for reading broadly, for searching broadly for your sources, even if you're just a consumer of news.
Absolutely.
You know, do you think we've got a pretty educated public in terms of information, or how do you think we're doing as an audience for information in the United States?
I don't know. I like to think so because, you know, I think the premier news outlets in this country are really pretty good.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, every once in a while you'll see a survey where people don't know where foreign countries are, you know, or, you know, people have notions about, you know, the science of, you know, climate change or whatever, you know, that, you know, miss a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of lack of education that's gone on here, you know. And so if we as news media aren't filling in those gaps, you know, or if we're not doing it in a way that changes people's minds or broadens people's outlook, then we're not doing our job.
Right. You know, there's so much distraction. I guess in that sense, I feel like sometimes it's hard to get through. You might have a great report, but people are really busy, it seems. Mm-hmm. There's lots of distractions. I did want to ask a little bit about social media. We talked earlier about the tools have all changed. You've gone from reel to digital and all that. But and you've been in the Middle East where, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how social media was influential. What do you think about that? Do you think that's just a new tool? Is the media using it well?
I'm not sure that the media is using it well. I think the media is behind the, you know, is behind the times as far as social media are concerned, and that. But I do think that the people in places like Egypt, for instance, are using it very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it is absolutely true. Whoops.
There we go. I'm sorry. Gosh, I was having such a good time. Corey, thank you so much for being on the air today.
It's my pleasure.
It's been really fun. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Charles Warforth is going to talk with leaders from both major political parties about how they recruit candidates for the legislative races and the training that goes into getting those candidates ready. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.